People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by BunnySlippers.com and FoundItemClothing.com. This is reading number 9.
The Shadow on the
this
Screen.
This is People's Guide Henry to the Cthulhu Cutler. Mythos.
The
find
weird
us on
story
Twitter,
of Hollywood.
Facebook.
And the grisly
Instagram.
Horror that casts its dreadful shadow across the silver screen as an incredible motion picture was run off. Torture Master was being given a sneak preview at the Beverly Hills Theater. Somehow, when my credit line directed by Peter Haviland was flashed on the screen, a little chill of apprehension shook me, despite the applause that came from the receptive audience. When you've been in the picture game for a long time, you get these hunches. I've often spotted a dud flicker before 100 feet have reeled off. Yet Torture Master was no worse than a dozen similar films I'd handed in the past few years. But it was formula. Box office formula. One could see that. The star was all right. The makeup department had done its job. The dialogue was unusually smooth. The film was obviously box office, and not the sort of film I'd like to direct. After watching a reel unwind amid the encouraging scattering of applause, I got up and went to the lobby. Some of the gang from Summit Pictures were lounging there smoking and commenting on the picture. Ann Howard, who played the heroine in Torture Master, noticed my scowl and pulled me to the corner. She was that rare type, a girl who will screen well without a lot of yellow grease paint that makes you look like an animated corpse. She was small and her hair and her eyes and skin were all brown. I'd like to see her play Peter Pan, that type, you know. I'd occasionally propose to her, but she never took me seriously. As a matter of fact, I myself didn't know how serious I was about it. Now she led me to the bar and ordered sidecars. "Don't look so miserable, Pete," she said over the rim of her glass. "The picture's going over. It'll gross enough to suit the boss, and it won't hurt my reputation." Well, that's right. Anne had a fat part. And she'd made the most of it. And the picture would be good box office. Universal's Night Key with Karloff had been released a few months ago. And the audiences were ripe for another horror picture. "I know," I told her, signaling the bartender to refill my glass. "But I get tired of these damn hokum picks. Lord, how I'd like to do another Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Or another Ape of God," Anne suggested. I shrugged. "Even that, maybe, but there's no such chance of development of the weird on the screen, Anne. And no producer will stand for a genuinely good picture of that type. They call it arty. They'll say it'll flop. If I branched out on my own, well, Hecht and MacArthur tried it, and they're back on the Hollywood payroll now." Someone Anne knew came up with and engaged her in conversation. I saw a man beckoning. With a hasty apology, left Anne to join him. It was Andy Wirth, Hollywood's dirtiest columnist. I knew him for a double-crosser and a skunk, but I also knew that he could get more inside information than a brace of winchels. He was a short, fat chap with a meticulously cultivated mustache and a sleeky, palmated black hair. Worth fancied himself a ladies' man and spent a great deal of his time trying to blackmail actresses into having affairs with him. That didn't make him a villain, of course. I like anybody who can carry on an intelligent conversation for 10 minutes, and Worth could do that. He fingered his mustache and said, "I heard you talking about Ape of God. A coincidence, Pete?" "Yes," I was cautious. I had to be with this walking scandal sheet. "What's that?" He took a deep breath. "Well, you understand, I haven't got the real lowdown, and there's all this hearsay, but I found a picture that'll make the weirdest flicker ever canned look side." I suspected a gag. "Okay, what is it, Torture Master?" "No, though Blake's yarn deserved better adaptation than you boys gave it. No, Pete, I'm talking about isn't for general release. It isn't completed. In fact, I saw a few rushes of it. A one-man affair titles The Nameless. Arnold Keene's doing it." Worth sat back and watched how I took that. And I must have shown my amazement, for it was Arnold Keene who had directed the notorious Ape of God, which had wrecked his promising career in films. The public doesn't know that picture. It was never released. Summit junked it. And they had good cause, although it was one of the most amazingly effective weird films I'd ever seen. Keene had shot most of it down in Mexico, and he'd been able to assume virtual dictatorship of a local troop. Several Mexicans had died at the time, and there had been some ugly rumors, but it had been hushed up. I'd talked with several people who had been down there, near Texaco with Keene, and they spoke of the man with particular horror. He had been willing to sacrifice almost anything to make Ape of God a masterpiece of its type. It was an unusual picture, there was no question about that. There's only one master print of the film, and it's kept in a locked vault at Summit. Very few have seen it, for what Mackin had done in weird literature, Keene had done on the screen, and it was literally amazing. I said to Worth, "Arnold Keene, eh? I've always had a sneaking sympathy for the man, but I thought he died long ago. Oh no, he bought a place near Tujunga and went into hiding. He didn't have much dough after the blow-up, you know, and it took him about 5 years to get together enough dinero to start his Nameless. He always said Ape of God was a failure, and he intended to do a film that would be a masterpiece of weirdness. Well, he's done it. He's canned a film that's unearthly. I tell you, it made my flesh creep. Who's the star?" I asked. "Unknowns. Russian trick, you know. The real star is a shadow." I stared at him. "That's right, Pete. A shadow of something that's never shown on the screen. Doesn't sound like much, eh? But you ought to see it." "I'd like to," I told him. "In fact, I'll do just that. Maybe he'll release it through Summit." Worth chuckled. "No chance no studio will release that flicker. I'm not even going to play it up in my dirt sheet. This is the real McCoy, Pete." "What's Keene's address?" I asked. Worth gave it to me. "But don't go until Wednesday night," he said. "The rough prints will be ready by then, or most of them. And keep it under your hat, of course." A group of autograph hunters came up just then, and Worth and I were separated. It didn't matter, I got all the information I needed. My mind was seething with fantastic surmises. Keene was one of the great geniuses of the screen, and his talent lay in a direction of the macabre. Unlike book publishers, the studio catered to no small discerning audiences, and a film must suit everyone. Finally, I broke away and took Anne to a dance at Bel Air. But I hadn't forgotten Keene, and the next night was too impatient to wait. I telephoned Worth, but he was out. Oddly enough, I was unable to get in touch with him during the next few days, and even his paper couldn't help me. A furious editor told me that the Associated Press had been sending him hourly telegrams asking for Worth's copy, but the man had vanished completely. I had a hunch. It was Tuesday night when I drove out to the studio and took a shortcut through Griffith Park, past the planetarium to Glendale. From there, I went to Tujunga, to the address Worth had given me. Once or twice, I had an uneasy suspicion that a black coupe was trailing me, but I couldn't be sure. Arnold Keene's house was in a little canyon hidden back in the Tujunga Mountains, and I had to follow a winding dirt road for several miles and form a stream or two before I readied it. The place was built against the side of the canyon, and the man stood on the porch and watched me as I braked my car to a stop. It was Arnold Keene. I recognized him immediately. He was a slender man under a middle height with a closely cropped bristle of gray hair. His face was coldly austere. There had been rumor that Keene had been at one time an officer in Prussia before he came to Hollywood and Americanized his name, and scrutinizing him, I could well believe it. His eyes were like that of pale blue marbles, curiously shallow. He said, "Peter Haviland, I did not expect you until tomorrow night." I shook hands. "Sorry if I intrude," I apologized. "The fact is, I got impatient after what Worth told me about your film. He isn't here, by any chance?" His shallow eyes were unreadable. "No, but come in. Luckily, the developing took less time than I had anticipated. I need only a few more shots to complete my task." He ushered me into the house, which was thoroughly modern and comfortably furnished under the influence of a good cognac, my suspicions began to dissolve. I told Keen I had always admired the Ape of God. He made a wry grimace, amateurish. Haviland, I depended too much on hokum in that film, merely devil worship, a reincarnated Gil de Ras and sadism. That isn't true weirdness. I was interested, that's correct. But the film had true, genuine power. Man has nothing of the weird in him intrinsically, and it is only the hints of the utterly abnormal and unhuman that gave one the true feeling of weirdness. That, and human reactions to such supernatural phenomena. Look at any great weird book, The Horla, which tells of a man's reaction to a creature utterly alien. Blackwood's Willows, Mackin's Black Seal, Lovecraft's Color Out of Space. All of these deal with the absolutely alien influencing normal lives. Sadism and death may contribute, but alone they cannot produce a true, intangible atmosphere of weirdness. I had read all those tales, but you can't film the indescribable. How could you show the invisible beings of the willows? Keen hesitated. I think I let my film answer that. I have a projection room downstairs. The bell rang sharply. I could not help noticing the quick glance Keen darted at. With an apologetic gesture, he went out and presently returned with Anne Howard at his side. She was smiling rather shakily. "Did you forget your date, Pete?" she asked me. I blinked and suddenly remembered 2 weeks ago I had promised to take Anne out to an affair at the Laguna Beach this evening. Having in my preoccupation with Keen's picture, the date had slipped my mind and stammered apologies. "Oh, that's right," she broke in. "I'd much rather stay here, that is, if Mr. Keen doesn't mind his picture." "You know about it." I told her," Keen said. When she explained why she had come, I took the liberty of inviting her to stay to watch the film. I did not want her to drag you away, you see," he finished, smiling. "Some cognac for Miss Anne?" I introduced them. "For Miss Howard and then the Nameless." At his words, the tiny warning note seemed to throb in my brain. It had been fingering a heavy metal paperweight, and now, as Keen's attention was momentarily diverted to the sideboard, I slipped it, on a sudden impulse, in my pocket. It would be no defense, though, against a gun. What was wrong with me, I wondered. An atmosphere of disgust and suspicion seemed to have sprung out of nothing as Keen ushered us down to his projection room. The skin of my back seemed to crawl with an expectation of attack. It was inexplicable, but definitely unpleasant. Keen was busy for a time in the projection booth, and then he joined us. "Modern machinery is a blessing," he said, with a heavy jocularity. "I can be as lazy as I wish. I need no help with the shooting. Once the automatic cameras were installed, the projector, too, is automatic." I felt Anne more closer to me in the gloom. I put my arm around her and said, "It helps, yes. What about releasing the picture, Mr. Keen?" There was a harsh note in his voice. "It will not be released. The world is uneducated, not ready for it. In 100 years, perhaps, it will achieve the fame it deserves. I am doing it for posterity, and for the sake of creating a weird masterpiece on the screen." With a muffled click, the projector began to operate, and a title flashed on the screen. The Nameless. Keen's voice came out of the darkness. "It's a silent film, except for one sequence, at the start. Sound adds nothing to the weirdness, and it helps to destroy the illusion of reality. Later, suitable music will be dubbed in." I did not answer, for a book had flashed on the gray oblong before us, that amazing tour de force, the Circus of Dr. Lau. A hand opened it, a long finger followed the lines as a toneless voice read,
"These are the sports, the off-throes of the universe instead of the species. These are the weird children, the lust of the spheres. Mysticism explains them where science cannot. Listen, when the great mysterious fecundity that peopled the worlds at the command of the gods had done with its birth-giving, when the celestial midwives all had left, when life had begun in the universe. The primal womb thing found itself unexhausted, its loins still potent, so that awful fertility on its couch, in a final fierce outbreak of life-giving, gave birth to these nightmare beings, these abortions of the world.
The book faded, and there swam into view a mass of tumbled ruins. The ages had pitted the man-carved rock with cracks and scars. The bias relief figures were scarcely recognizable. I was reminded of certain ruins I'd seen in the Yucatan. The camera swung down. The ruins seemed to grow larger. A yawning hole gaped in the earth. Beside me, Keen said, "The site of a ruined temple. Watch now." The effect was that of moving forward into the depths of a subterranean pit. For a moment, the screen was in darkness. Then a stray beam of sunlight rested on an idol that stood in what was apparently an underground cavern. A narrow crack of light showed in the roof. The idol was starkly hideous. I got only a flashing glimpse, but the impression on my mind was that of a bulky, ovoid shape like a pineapple or a pine cone. The thing had certain doubtful features which lent in a definitely unpleasant appearance. But it was gone in a flash, dissolving into a brightly litted drawing room thronged with gay couples. The story proper began at that point. None of the actors or actresses known to me. Keen must have hired them and worked secretly in his house. Most of the interiors and a few of the exteriors seemed to be taken in this very canyon. The director had used the parallel trick, which saves so much money for studios early. I've done it myself. It simply means that the story is tied in with a real life as closely as possible. That is, when I had a troop working up at Lake Arrowhead last winter, and unexpected snowfall changed the scene, I had the continuity rewritten so that the necessary scenes would take place in snow. Similarly, Keen had paralleled his own experiences, something almost too closely. The Nameless told of a man ostracized by his fellows because of his fanatical passion of the morbid and the bizarre, who determined to create a work of art, a living masterpiece of sheer weirdness. He had experimented before by directing films that were sufficiently unusual to stir up a considerable comment, but this did not satisfy him. It was acting, and he wanted something more than that. No one can convincingly fake reaction to horror, not even the most talented actor, he contended. The genuine emotion must be felt in order to be transferred to the screen. It was here that the Nameless ceased to parallel Keen's own experiences and branched into sheer fantasy. The protagonist of the film was Keen himself, but this was not unusual, as directors often act in their own productions. And by deft montage shots, the audience learned that Keen, in his search for authenticity, had gone down into Mexico, and had, with the aid of an ancient scroll, found the site of a ruined Aztec temple. And here, as I say, reality left behind as the film entered a morbid and extraordinary phase. There was a god hidden beneath this ruined temple, a long-forgotten god which had been worshipped even before the Aztecs had sprung from the womb of the centuries. At least the natives had considered it a god, and had erected a temple in its honor, but Keen hinted that the thing was actually a survival, one of the off-throes of the universe, unique and baroque, which had come down through the eons in an existence totally alien to mankind. The creature was never actually seen on the screen, save for a few brief glimpses in the shadowed underground temple. It was roughly barrel-shaped and perhaps 10 feet high, studded with odd spiky projections. The chief feature was a gem set in the beam's rounded apex, a smoothly polished jewel as large as a child's head. It was in this gem that the beam's life was supposed to have its focus. It was not dead, but it was neither alive, in the accepted sense of the term. When the Aztecs had filled the temple with the hot stench of blood, the thing had lived, and The jewel had flamed with unearthly radiance, but with the passage of time, the sacrifices had ceased and the being had sunk into a state of coma akin to hibernation, and the pitcher Keen brought it to life. He transported it secretly to his home, and there, in the underground room hollowed beneath the house, he placed the monster god. The room was built with an eye for the purpose of the windy Keen intended it. Automatic cameras and clever lighting features were installed so that pictures could be shot from several different angles at once and pieced together later as Keen cut the film. And now entered something of the touch of genius where made Keen famous. He was clever, I always realized that, yet in the scenes that were next unfolded I admired not so much as the technical tricks which were familiar to me enough as the marvelously clever way in which Keen had managed to inject realism into his acting. His character did not say, they lived, or rather, they died, for in the pictures they were thrust into the underground room to die horribly as sacrifices to the monster god of the Aztec temple. Sacrifice was supposed to bring the thing to life, to cause the jewel in which its existence was bound to flare up with fantastic splendor. The first sacrifice, I think, was the most effective. The underground room in which the god was hidden was large but quite vacant save for the curtained alcove which held the idol. A barred doorway led to an upper room where Keen had appeared on the screen, revolver in hand, herding before him a man, overall clad, with a stubble of black beard on his solid face. Keen swung open the door, motioned the captive to open the great room. He closed the barred door, and through the grating could be seen busy at the switchboard. A light flared, a man stood near the bars, and then, at Keen's gesture with the weapon, moved forward slowly on the far wall. He stood there staring around vaguely, a dull apprehension in his face. Light threw his shadow in bold relief on the wall. Another shadow leaped into existence behind him. It was barrel-shaped, gigantic, studded with blunt spikes, and capped by a round, dark blob, the life jewel. The shadow of the monster god. The man saw it, he turned. Stark horror sprang into his face. At the sight of the utterly ghastly and realistic expression, a chill struck through me. It was almost too convincing. But the man could not be merely acting. But if he was, his acting was superb, and was Keen's direction. The shadow on the wall stirred, and a thrill of movement shook it. It rocked and seemed to rise, supporting a dozen tentacular appendages that uncoiled from beneath its base. The spikes changed. They lengthened, they coiled, they withered, hideous, worm-like. It wasn't the metamorphosis of the shadow that held me motionless in my chair. Rather, it was the appalling expression of sheer horror on the man's face. He stood gasping at the shadow, toppled and swayed on the wall, growing larger and larger. Then he fled, his mouth open, square of terror. And then the shadow paused, with an odd air of indecision, and slipped slowly along the wall out of range of the camera. But there were other cameras, and Keen had used his cutting shears deftly. The movements of the man were mirrored on the screen, and the glaring lights swung and flared. And even the grim shadow crawled hideously across the wall. The thing that cast it was never shown, just the shadow. And it was a dramatically effective trick. Too many directors I knew could not have resisted the temptation to show the monster, thus destroying the illusion, for papier-mâché or rubber, no matter how cleverly constructed, cannot convincingly ape reality. At last, the shadows merged. The gigantic swaying thing with its colliding tentacles and the black shadow of the man that were caught and lifted, struggling and kicking frantically. The shadows merged, and the man did not reappear. Only the dark blob capping and the great shadow faded and flickered, as though the strange light were streaming from it, and the light that was fed by the sacrifice, the jewel that was life. Beside me, there came a little rustle. I felt Anne stir and move closer in the gloom. Keen's voice came from some distance away. There were some more sacrifice scenes, Havilland, but I haven't patched them in yet, except for the one that you'll see in any moment now. As I said, the film isn't finished. I did not answer. My eyes were on the screen as the fantastic tale unfolded. The pitcher Keen was bringing another victim to his cavern, a short fat man with sleekly pulmonated hair. I did not see his face until he had been imprisoned in the cave, and then abruptly there came a close-up shot, possibly done with a telescopic lens. His plump face with its tiny mustache leaped into gigantic visibility, recognized Andy Worth. It was the missing columnist, but for the time I saw his veneer of sophistication lacking, naked fear crawled in his eyes, and I leaned forward in my seat as the ghastly barrow-shaped shadow sprang out of the wall. Worth saw it, and the expression on his face was shocking. I pushed back in my chair and got up as the lights came on and the screen went blank. Arnold Keene was staggering by the door, erect and military as ever. He had a gun in his hand, and the muzzle was aimed at my stomach. "You'd better sit down, Haviland," he said quietly. "You too, Miss Howard. I've got something to tell you, and I don't wish to be melodramatic about it. This gun," he glanced at it wryly, "it's necessary. There are a few things you must know, Haviland, for a reason you'll understand later," I said. "There'll be some visitors for you soon, Keen. You don't think I'd neglect normal precautions?" He shrugged. "You're lying, of course. You aren't armed. Or you'd have your gun out by now. I didn't expect you until tomorrow night, but I'm prepared. In a word, what I have to tell you is this. The film you just saw is a record of actual events." Anne's teeth sank into her lip. I didn't say anything. I waited, and Keen resumed. "Whether you believe me or not doesn't matter. You'll have to believe it in a few minutes, as I told you. Something of my motive, my desire to create a genuine masterpiece of weirdness, and that's what I've done, or will have done by tomorrow. Quite a number of vagrants and laborers have disappeared, and the columnist Worth, well, I took care to leave no clues. But you'll be the last to vanish, you and this girl. You'll never be able to show this film," I told him. "What of it? You're a hack, Haviland, and you don't understand what it means to create a masterpiece. Is a work of art any less beautiful because it's hidden? I'll see the picture, and after I'm dead, the world will see it and recognize my genius, even though they may fear and hate its expression. The reaction of my unwilling actors, that's the trick. As a director, you should know that there's no substitute for realism. The reactions were not faked. That was obvious enough. The first sacrifice was that of a clod, an unintelligent moron, whose fears were largely superstitious. The next sacrifice was a higher type, a vagrant who'd come banging at my door some months ago. You will complete the group, for you'll know just what you're facing, and your attempt to rationalize your fear will lead to an interesting touch. Both of you will stand up, your hands in the air, and proceed into this passage." All this came out tonelessly and swiftly, quite as though it were a rehearsed speech. His hand slid over the wall behind him, and a black oblong widened in the oak paneling. I stood up. "Do as he says, Anne," I said. "Maybe I can." "No, you can't," Keen interrupted, gesturing impatiently with his weapon. "You don't have the chance. Hurry up." We went through the opening in the wall, and Keen followed, touching a stud that flooded the passage with light. It was a narrow tunnel that slanted down through the rock for perhaps 10 feet into a steep stairway. He herded us down after sliding the panel shut. "It's well hidden," he said, indicating the metal sheathing. Indeed, the entire corridor was lined with metal plates. "The lever opens it from within, but no one but me can find the spring which opens it from without. The police could wreck the house without discovering the passage." That seemed something worth remembering, but of practical value at the moment. Anne and I went down the stairway until it ended into another short passage. Our way was blocked by a door of steel bars, which Keen unlocked with a key he took from his pocket. The passage where he stood was dimly lighted. There were several chairs here, and the space beyond the bar door was not lighted at all. Keen opened the door and gestured me through it. He locked me behind and turned to Anne. Her face, I saw, was paper white in the pale glow. What happened after that brought an angry curse to my lips. Without warning, Keen swung the automatic in a short, vicious arc, smashing it against Anne's head. She saw it coming too late, but her upflung hand failed to ward off the blow. She dropped without a sound, a little trickle of blood oozing from her temple. Keen stepped over her body to a switchboard set in the rock wall. Light lanced with intolerable brilliance into my eyes. I shut them tightly, opening them after a moment to stare around, almost apprehensively. I recognized my surroundings. It was the Cave of Sacrifice, the underground den I had seen on the screen. Cameras high up on the walls began to operate as I discovered them from various points. Blinding arc lights streamed down upon me. A gray curtain shielded a space from the far wall, but this was drawn upward to reveal a deep alcove. There was an object within the niche, a barrel-shaped thing, 10 feet high, studded with spikes, and crowned with a jewel that pulsed and glittered with cold flame. It was gray and varnished looking, and it was the original of Keen's Aztec god. Somehow I felt oddly reassured as I examined the thing. It was a model, of course, inanimate and dead, for uncertainly no life of any sort could exist in such an abnormality. Keen might have installed machinery of some sort within it, however. "You see, Haviland," Keen said from beyond the bars.
You see, Haviland, Keen said from behind the bars, the thing actually exists. I got on the trail of it in an old parchment I found in the Huntington Library. It had been considered merely an interesting bit of folklore, but I saw something else in it. And when making Ape of God in Mexico, I discovered that the ruined temple and what lay forgotten behind in the altar. He touched a switch and... Swiftly I turned. On the wall behind me was my own shadow, grotesquely elongated, and beside me was a squat, amorphous patch of blackness I had seen on the screen upstairs. My back was towards Keen, and my fingers crept into my pocket, touching the metal paperweight I had dropped there earlier that evening. Briefly, I considered the possibility of hurling the thing at Keen, and then decided against it. The bars were too close together, and the man would shoot me at any sign of dangerous hostility. My eyes were drawn close to the shadow on the wall. It was moving. It rocked slightly and lifted, and spikes lengthened. The thing was no longer inanimate and dead, and it swung about. Stark amazement gripped me. I saw the incredible metamorphosis that had taken place in that thing that cast the shadow. It was no longer barrel-shaped. A dozen smooth, glistening appendages ended in flat pads, supported the snake-thin body, and all over the grayish, upright pole tentacles sprouted and lengthened, withering in a ghastly life as the horror awakened. Keen had not lied. The monster survival he had brought from the Aztec temple was lumbering from the alcove, its myriad of tentacles alive with frightful hunger. Keen saved me. He saw me standing motionless with abysmal fear in the path of the gigantic nightmare being, and realizing that he was being cheated of his picture, the man shouted at me to run. His hoarse voice broke the spell that held me unmoving, and I whirled, fled across the cave to the barred door, skin ripped from my hands as I tore at the door. "Run!" Keen yelled at me, his shallow eyes blazing. "I can't move fast. Look out!" A writhing snake thing lashed out, and its sickening, musty stench filled my nostrils. I leaped away, racing across the cave again. The arc lights died, and the others flared into being as Keen manipulated the switchboard, as he adjusted the light, as so our shadows would not be lost, so that in the climax of the nameless, the shadow of that ghastly horror would be thrown on the cave at the wall beside me. It was an infernal game of tag we played there, and those shifting lights that glared down at the intense lenses watched dispassionately. I fled and dodged with my pulses thundering and the blood pounding in my temples, and ever the grim shadow moved slowly across the walls while my legs began to ache from the strain. From hours, perhaps eons, I fled. There would be brief periods of respite where I would cling to the bars, cursing Keen, but he would not answer. His hands flicked over the switchboard as he adjusted the arc lights, as his eyes never paused in the roving examination of the cave. And in the end, it was just this that saved me. For Keen did not see Anne stir and open her eyes. He did not see the girl after a swift glance around, quietly to her feet. Luckily, she was behind Keen, and he did not turn. I tried to keep my eyes away from Anne, but I do not think I succeeded. At the last moment, I saw Keen's face change, and he startled back. But the chair in Anne's hands crashed down and splintered on the man's head. He fell to his knees, clawing at the air, and then collapsed inertly. I was on the far side of the cave, and my attention was momentarily diverted from the monster. I had been watching it from the corner of my eye. Expecting to be able to dodge and leap away from it, I came too close, but it lumbered forward with a sudden burst in speed. Although I tried to clear the air, I failed, and a tentacle whipped about my leg and sent me sprawling. As I tried to roll away, another smooth gray coil got my left arm. Intolerable agony dug into my shoulder as I was lifted. I heard Anne scream, and the gun barked angrily, bullets plopping onto the smooth flesh of the monster, but it paid no attention. I was lifted through a welter of roping tentacles. Just above me was the flaming jewel in which the creature's life was centered. Remembering of Keen's words sputtered me to action. This might be the monster's vulnerable point. The paperweight was still in my pocket, and I clawed for it desperately. I hurled it with all my strength at the shining gem, and the jewel shattered. There came in a shrill vibration, like the tinkling of countless tiny crystalline bells, piercingly sweet. It shrilled in my ears and died away quickly, and suddenly nothing existed but light. It was though the shattering of the gem had released a sea of incandescent flames imprisoned within it. The glare of the arc lights faded beside the flood of silvery radiance that bathed me. the cold glory of Arcteus, the blaze of tropical moonlight, were in the light. Swiftly it faded and fled away. I felt myself dropping, and pain lanced into my wretched shoulder as I struck the ground. I heard Anne's voice. Dazed, I got up, expecting to see the monster towering above me, but it was gone. In its place a few feet away was the barrel-shaped thing I had first seen in the alcove. There was a gaping cavity in the rounded apex where the jewel had been, and somehow I sensed the creature was no longer deadly, no longer a horror. I saw Anne. She was holding Keen's gun, and in her other hand was the key with which she had unlocked the door. She came running towards me. I went swiftly to meet her. I took the gun and made sure it was loaded. "Come on," I said curtly. "We're getting out of here." Anne's fingers were gripping my arm tightly as we went through the door. Past the prone figure of Keen up in the stairway, the lever behind the panel was not difficult to operate, and I followed Anne through the opening into the theater. Then I paused listening. Anne turned, watching me, a question in her eyes. "What is it, Pete?" "Listen," I said. "Get the cans of film from the projection booth. We'll take them with us and burn them." "But you're not." "I'll be with you in a minute," I told her, and swung the panel shut. I went down the stairs swiftly and very quietly, my gun ready and my ears alert for the low muttering I had heard below. Keen was no longer unconscious. He was standing beside the switchboard with his back turned to me, and over his shoulder I could see the shadow of the monster god sprawling on the wall. Inert and lifeless, Keen was chanting something in a language I did not know, and his hands were moving in strange gestures. God knows what unearthly powers Keen had acquired in his search for horror, for as I stood there watching the patch of blackness on the cave wall, I saw a little shudder rock the barrel-shaped shadow of horror, while a single spike abruptly lengthened into a tentacle that roped out futilely and drew back and vanished. And then I killed Arnold Keen. That was The Shadow on the Screen by Henry Kuttner. That was from Weird Tales, Volume 31, Issue 3. This work is of the public domain in the United States because it was legally published within the United States before 1964, and the copyright was not renewed. Henry Kuttner, which we will talk about in the next episode of People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I have been your host, D.B. Spitzer. Remember, you can check us out on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. You can go to pgttcm.com and check out what we've got going on there, and check out the RSS feed if you don't feel like looking for us on iTunes or Stitcher or many of the other places that you can find us. But if you do listen to us on iTunes or Stitcher, remember to subscribe, rate, and review People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Thank you so much. I've been D.B. Spitzer. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is brought to you by Found Item Clothing and BunnySlippers.com. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is edited by D.B. Spitzer, produced by D.B. Spitzer, and hosted by D.B. Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod. People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos is part of the Dark Myths Collective. Check them out at darkmyths.org. That's darkmyths.org. All right, thank you for listening. And remember, we've got a Patreon at patreon.com/pgttcm. And if you're going to check out any of the books that I suggest, go to pgttcm.com, go to where we have the reviews, and you can actually click on the books and go and get them on Amazon. And I get a very, very, very small percentage. You know, that's cool. All right, thank you. Jim Pyre has a suggestion for an outro, which is Jim Pyre, I think he said? Yeah, Jim Pyre, which is keep it squiggly. So maybe we'll try and keep it squiggly. If you have a suggestion for an outro, let me know. Maybe we'll vote on one. I like keep it squiggly, but hey, what do you like? All right.